Alright, I'll give it a shot. It's called Paranoid. I'm paranoid, and I don't know why. Feels like someone's staring at me through my own eyes. When I look in the mirror, I can't linger too long because I'm paranoid. Whoa, stop whispering when you're talking about me. I know just what you're doing. I'm not too blind to see. I've even heard them talking about me on the TV. I guess I'm paranoid. My imagination is playing tricks on me, and I don't know what's really going on. There may be medication to set my mind at ease. This crazy situation has brought me to my knees. I'm paranoid, and I'm not ashamed, even though the radio just repeats my name. And I don't seem to benefit from this type of fame. My picture perfect life is slipping from the frame. It's serious to me, but to you it's just a game. I know there's nothing wrong with me. I know
where did that come from?
One of many.
No, but I mean, when did you do that?
Oh, 2002, 2003, 2004,
so you were where?
In Cleveland. I was in Cleveland.
You were without a release date?
Just exploring, not so much about the release date, but just exploring my illness, paranoid schizophrenia. It came to me when I went into my bathroom back when I had my own room. Boy, I hadn't thought about having my own room for a long time. It's funny how you're living and how you're forced to survive becomes so ingrained in a part of your life that when you're removed from it, extricated from it, or gone to an improved situation, all of that doesn't leave you, but somehow you don't think of it. But anyways,
so you had your own room.
I had my own room with a bathroom, even better. And I went into the bathroom for a second, and after being medicated and stabilized for many years, and kind of like geared towards getting out, even though there was no release date, but I was just positive and wasn't thinking about being ill, because when you're well, you don't think about being ill. You're well now. Sometimes to your detriment, in only in that you forget that you're sick. And which is a big mistake that a lot of people who are mentally ill make after they get stabilized for a year or two or three or more. It's like all of a sudden, not only am I not sick, I don't need the medication anymore. And that becomes a whole big problem. So I'd forgotten about my being ill, but didn't forget about the medication because I was getting the shots every month. But somehow I was coming out of the bathroom, and there's a bathroom mirror, and I just walked out and was about to turn the light off. I caught a glimpse of myself out of the corner of my eye. And it felt like paranoia. It felt, and not that I was symptomatic, but I had an understanding of, or just like a glimpse of the illness, which is just looking in the mirror, and it's someone else looking at you, even though it's you. And that's why I came with the line, I'm paranoid, I don't know why, it feels like someone's staring at me through my own eyes. You know, it's like you recognize yourself, but you're projecting so much everyone else's hatreds and everyone else's problems that they have with you on you through you. It's like a weird kind of thing that I'm not smart enough to coherently articulate. But I'm just saying, catching that quick glimpse of the corner of my eye of myself was like, and I said to myself, I'm paranoid, because even though I was very well medicated, there was just like a glimmer, a very millisecond of a glimmer of just looking and seeing myself and being critical of myself and wondering what other people are thinking of me. That's it. Just in a split second, it was just a flash. And it wasn't a symptomatic thing. It was just like just a recognition of my illness. It's like, wow. And I stopped and said, I'm paranoid. And then I wrote the song. Which began, you know, paranoid, and I don't know why. Feels like someone's staring at me with my own eyes. When I look in the mirror, I don't linger too long because I'm paranoid. That's where that whole line came from. I just felt compelled to finish the song. Whether it's any good, I don't know. So that's where that comes from.
Well, that's pretty revealing and insightful to see yourself paranoid through your own eyes.
While you're well. Yeah.
But now you spent 10 years being, of the 20, being symptomatic.
No, I can't say that.
How would you describe your first 10 years?
My first 10 years I wasn't symptomatic, but I was on a different medication, maybe 8 years of that. I was on Stelazine, which you'll even talk to another person, DW, who, with his God complex, who was on the same medicine that I was on, and he experienced a lot of the same problems that I experienced on it, which is that it was effective, but unlike other medications, this one is well known to somehow, your body tolerates it and compensates after a while and grows used to it, and its effectiveness decreases. And while when you first started taking it for a couple of years, and many years, your right is rain, more or less. After a while, the illness peaks through. It's like somehow the threshold reduces, and the illness pokes through from time to time. And then after a while, your body has grown, your mind and your body has grown used to this medication, and it's no longer effective in some people. And it was that case with me, and it was that case with DW. So that's the commonality that we shared, and we'd speak at length about, not length, but we'd talk about that from time to time. And that's a scary feeling. Because you want to be on something that works. So, not to say that ever so once in a while I was flipping out, even though there were periods of where I was having decompensations, where I was coming off the medication or taking myself off the medication or whatever, or cheeking it and not taking it. But there were also episodes where I was taking it every day religiously, and I'd be sitting having a conversation, or in the midst of a conversation with two or three people, and as they're talking and I'm talking, all of a sudden I'll just be struck. And I'll start thinking to myself, they're talking about me, aren't they? They're talking about me. What did you say? And you're like, in your mind, sitting there like a deer in the headlights, trying to smile, like, yeah, I'm enjoying this conversation. Meanwhile, in your mind, you're thinking, he just called me a nigger, but in, like, Japanese. How did he know Japanese? You know, and just yeah, you just go to these strange places, and that lasts like maybe 5 or 8 minutes, and just as quickly as it hits you, you snap at it, and then you find yourself going, oh, "Okay, I'm back." That was weird.
Where were you?
You were in insanity. You were in crazy. You were in a crazy place. You were in your mind was as it was, not as it was. Aided or somehow ameliorated by the medication or arrested by the medication, but somehow your mind broke free of the chemical straitjacket and was running loose. And that's who you really are. And I have to recognize that. And I've learned to recognize that. That is who I really am. After the marijuana and after the illness and the trauma, I'm a paranoid schizophrenic. And when my mind is loose and free from the chemical straitjacket, it's a scary place. Not in terms of, like, I'm thinking, I can't wait to push some lady in front of a subway train, but just in terms of just full of doubt and fear. That's what fuels me. Doubt and fear. Insecurity.
And where does that come from?
Heaven only knows. Probably from my childhood, being abused, sexually abused, coming from the household I came from where I didn't really know who my parents really were because they were always high. So intrinsically, like deep inside my deepest core, I loved them, they loved me, my mother's relationship and I will go down history as one of the greatest love affairs in the world, yet I didn't really know her. And that's a very insecure feeling. As much as we loved each other, and I have great memories of her, and she taught me how to paint, and she cradled me through life until her life was ended, unfortunately, through my own means, through my own hand, but which is a whole other mindfuck. But deep, deep, deep down, the truth of it, I didn't know my parents. I didn't know my mother. I didn't know my father. I don't know if I really ever knew my siblings. I grew up with them, and I knew them as children. But by the time I was old enough to know my sisters, they were not only taking pot, but taking LSD in the late 60s, as most kids were, or teenagers. And my brothers, what little bit I knew of them as children, changed dramatically when they started smoking pot at 10, 12, 13, 14, 15. And so...
And you did too.
And I didn't know my family, and as a result, when I started smoking, I didn't know myself. Years later, but it's like you know,
you
get into your head when you smoke, and if it's filled with if whatever's in your head, and you get high, or then when you as a result get sick, it regurgitates, and magnifies, and permutates. So my thing is fear and doubt and insecurity as a result of my upbringing. And so that's magnified and transmogrified when I get sick and turns into a whole mess of craziness, a whole mess of just, I can't live. I can't survive. They'll know. Who'll know? I don't know, but they'll know. It just turns into a whole internal dialogue where you're walking down the street and heaven forbid and you have to wear your shades. Because if I didn't have my shades, my eyes would be, you know, and being ping-ponging back and forth. And people be, but while I'm doing it, I'm looking at people through my shades as they cast a glance at me, as anybody would. I guess, if they're walking down the street, some people will look, some people won't. But heaven forbid, if they look, then it's a disparaging look. If they don't look, then they're ignoring you and don't think you're worth anything. It's just everything is just referential and metaphorical and just crazy. It's a sad, sad, sad thing. I know there are a lot of people going through it right now on the streets, and I feel for them because it's hell. It's hell. It's hell.
You had this.
It was hell for me. Let me just say it was hell. There's some people who fly with euphoria and love it, and good for them if they can do that safely. But for me, it wasn't euphoria. It was abject, total, total fear. Fear of humiliation. Fear of being found out, whatever the found out was. Fear of just you know, insecurity. It's total insecurity. And I still feel that way. I'm still insecure. I'll always be insecure. But I've learned to manage these things and use it to my advantage. You know? Write a song about it. And then sing it. Get over your fear. Cause I, as fearful as I am, I love to sing. So while I don't want to perform necessarily, the love of the music and the confidence that I have in the song that I wrote, thinking that, you know, somebody might get this. Let me sing this because I love to sing. Let me try and sing this. And then if somebody does get it and you get applause, then it's like, well, okay, that's validation. And so it helps you get over yourself doing what I do. So I'm using, like Yana said, and Bull, like using my vulnerability as a weapon. Oh, not so much as a weapon, but as a strength.
Drawing from that, too. But your vulnerability went to your you called it new speak?
Subspeak.
Subspeak.
Subtle speak. Subspeak.
Subspeak.
It was subtle speech. It was nuance. It was syntax, you know? It was how we speak. Not just what we're saying, but how we're saying it. I mean, it's already, it was already a riddle what people were saying, because the English language is just so all-encompassing and enveloping. But then when somebody throws a little bit of brio on it, or a little bit of, like, a little bit of English on it, or a little bit of attitude, or just the way you say it, the syntax, would throw me into a tither. You know, I go into a bar with a guy, and he says, "This girl's looking at you." I said, "Really? Mm-hmm. They look cute, you know. They look kind of not from New York, and they like give me the eye across the bar, and you know, they had like their little glasses or whatever, and it would look like beer or whatever." So I go, he says, "Go talk to him. Maybe you'll get something tonight." And God knows I needed to get something, as I was like 21, 22 years old, 23. So, I mean, I get up the courage is something I never do, which is go over and speak to a woman cold. But this guy's, I'm on the spot now, because this guy thinks I'm some stud, you know, because he's some Nebuchadnezzar Jewish guy, a friend of mine. So I'm like, I got to show up now, okay. So I go over them, "Hey, how you doing?" "Hello." And they sound like the European. "Oh, okay. What you drinking?" "Hot chocolate." And I know they're not drinking hot chocolate. But just the way, and this is where it gets fucked up, because I know they're making a sexual advance, and yet I'm so screwed up by the subspeak and unable to say, to give a response back. I was inadequate. It was my inadequacy. It was my shyness and my inability to come back with a quick remark. "Hot chocolate. I got some of that. In my place, would you like some?" You know, that would have been the perfect response. But I was like, and I walk away like an idiot. And they're looking at me like, this guy blowing, you know? And because, those like real examples of what is flirtation or just, you know, equivocation or... You know, but I took it to mean like, oh shit, people are talking like this all the time. I gotta brush up on this, you know? And it was just crazy, because now I'm thinking everything everybody says has to be double and triple thought. So my conversations with people were kept very curt and impenetrable, because when I would have a conversation with somebody, I'd be like, yeah, okay. And I'd have to double and triple think everything they said. You know, and try to figure out, try to crack the nut of, would you like to have a cup of coffee? Have a cup of coffee. Is he offering me his dick? Does he want some of my dick? Coffee black? You know, I'm thinking all this crazy shit. And then he says, okay, this guy's a nut. And so he walks, and so like, I was just like a real weirded out New York character. That when, after the whole incident with my mother happened, one of my other close friends, who was another rock and roll Jew, great guy, I called him from jail, Rikers Island, and he heard about what happened. He said, "I heard about what happened." Yeah. And he said, "Did you do it?" I said, "Yeah." I kind of thought, you didn't you see what was going on? Didn't you notice how I lost my mind? I'm smoking too much pot. I think I told you a couple of times I need to stop smoking. I remember that. I said, yeah, I was losing my mind. I went insane. I went crazy. And what happened. And I said, "Didn't you notice? I mean, I was around you a lot at that time, didn't you?" And he said, "No, I just thought you were another rock and roll freak, you know? I just thought you were another rock and roll freak." Because he's seen them all, you know? So, he, like many other people, didn't notice I was losing my mind. He just thought I was a crazy artist. And I was, but I was also crazy in a very real sense.
But this happened before, you know, talk to me a little bit about your relationship to marijuana and your upbringing.
I grew up in a household of marijuana. I grew up in a marijuana household. Some people grow up in alcoholic households, or physical abuse households, or Italian pasta and marinara sauce households. I mean, it's staples in their lives that become a part of their culture and who they are. I grew up in a marijuana household.
But you didn't smoke.
I didn't smoke it. But
why didn't you smoke it?
Because I like I said earlier, I couldn't articulate it, and it took me many years and several therapists to realize what it was. Is that I was out of contact with my family, my parents especially. That's much my siblings. It's definitely my siblings, yes, but they don't count as much as your parents, in a nurturing sense. And though I couldn't quite articulate it and didn't know what it was, I was out of contact with my parents. I was out of contact with my mother, especially. My father was gigging all the time and sleeping when he was home, so I didn't have, like, the greatest relationship with him to begin with. Not that it was bad, but it was just very distant.
How many brothers and sisters?
Two older brothers, two older sisters. But my mother, I was with her constantly. But, she was high all the time, well, most of the time. And when she wasn't high, they were coming off the high, you know, which is a whole other thing. It's like you're not high, but you're still not quite 100%. You're sluggish, or you're any number of things after smoking for not only just a day, but 21,000 days before that, you know. So it's in her system, and it's just it's part of who she is. It's a part of who she is. I love her, and I will always love her. And it made her who she was, a very cool, artsy, hip, funny, intelligent woman. But it also made her from a mothering standpoint, I'm not saying she was a bad mother, but in terms of like forming a real connection, I had a connection with her, but I felt as a child, and I wish I couldn't articulate, and growing up, I got used to it, but it felt uncomfortable, and it probably caused a lot of my predisposition to illness, or latent illness, because I just felt disconnected from my mother and from my family. I felt disconnected, and I felt alone, which is why I can function so well alone, by myself, as a loner. And then, it's so weird, I was a loner since a child. And then I get into the system because doing something unspeakable to my mother, involving my mother, and then end up in a hospital where I'm alone, basically, because you're one man trying to find his sanity and survive amongst total insanity. So I know what it's like to be alone, and I almost embrace loneliness or insularity. That's a better word. I can survive. Because I've survived all my life using my own, whatever it is, resources. Because I never had, really, a secure feeling knowing that my family have my back. My family have me. And it turns out, after my mother passes, my family don't have me. They drop me like a hot rock. So, it bears itself out. It bears itself out. So, it's just interesting. So, my relationship to marijuana is I hate it. I love it and I hate it. The smell of it, really, I can understand Richard Smith walking through that cloud, boy. Because it's a beguiling smell. For me, it's I can identify it quicker than I identify the scent of a rose. And it's even more attractive to me than the scent of a rose or a honeysuckle. It's the smell of my childhood. It's the smell of my mother. It's the smell of my home. It's the smell of my roots. You know, and so it's deep inside. So it's no wonder why when my father passes and my brother hands me a joint, I take it and I just say, oh yes, oh yes. You know, and I just start smoking every day afterwards.
But how much were you smoking?
Enough. For me, it was enough to go crazy. It doesn't matter how much I was smoking. I lost my mind, did a horrible thing. I smoked enough. You know, I smoked enough.
Yeah, but some people smoke every 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes.
Well, I wasn't doing that, but I was smoking enough. It doesn't matter how much I was smoking. I lost my mind.
You smoked a joint today? Or
I don't know if it was a joint today. Initially, it was just like every weekend, you know. And then the weekend started on Thursday and ended on Monday and then Tuesday. And then before you know it, there's only one day not smoking. It's Wednesday, because that's when you get your check. And then you find yourself accelerating from that, where you can't wait to get your check to buy pot, and you spend every, and you thank God that you're living at home, so that you don't have to really pay rent and even eat anymore. You can just put most of the lion's share of your check into buying pot and keeping you high and keeping you stabilized, you know, and in that state of wherever you're at, that keeps you kind of wherever you need to be at that point in your life, which is where I was at that point in my life. I just need to be high. I lost my father, my mother, and I got to see my mother for who she really was, which was a bitter, lonely old widow who started dating other men. Another man. And the uneasiness of knowing that there's another man coming into my house having sex with my mother. You know, I hope this doesn't bring up Oedipal things that, because when I brought this up to Hagerty, she had a field day. Oh, of course, that's why you killed it. And I was like, oh my God, what are you fucking talking? No, don't you understand? Oedipus. And I was like, no! But, you know, for any man who loves his mother and loses their father, there's got to be a grieving period. And my mother did grieve. She did grieve. But eventually, I noticed there's this guy started to hang around. And I realized he's fucking her. He's fucking my mother. You know, and it's an uneasy feeling. Because I knew how sexual my mother was, too. Growing up in a house and she was a libertine. And it was a house of I don't want to say low morals or loose morals, but it was a loose house. You know, I heard my parents have sex numerous times in the next room, and you know, it was a bohemian lifestyle. Let's just say that.
Of the 50s and 60s?
Of the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. And so by the early 70s, I discovered swinging magazines in my house, and then couples coming over a lot more. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. And I realized, okay, my parents are swingers. Okay, this is the 70s, the suburbs, all right. You know, and but when I got to see my mother for who she really was, it was startling and sad. Pathetic. Sad. But I shouldn't say pathetic, but just it was sad. It was sad.
How old were you?
I was 22. And she was 54, which is young. I'll be 53, 54 in a couple of years, so I can understand her still wanting to have sex, and still wanting to have a life, and still wanting to smoke.
How much after your father died did this happen?
Maybe a year or two.
So that's when you started smoking dope?
Right after he died is when I started smoking dope. The day after he died.
But the day before that,
you hadn't smoked in your whole life?
I hadn't smoked. Even though you had secondhand highs.
I don't know if I had secondhand highs. Who's to say? I didn't even know what a secondhand high was. I was so out of the loop. I was so square in my house. I was the square in the house. Trust me. Everyone else in that house was super hip. And I was a stone cold square. I couldn't roll for shit. I couldn't tell grades of pot one from the other. Acapulco what? Hawaiian what? Blah, what? You know, I didn't know what that was. Because I wasn't a connoisseur. You know?
Didn't they offer you smoke pot? Why didn't you take it?
They didn't offer me. They never offered me. Because when I was 13, maybe 12 or 13, I came out of my room one day after hearing them do one of their many bullshit sessions around the circle of the table in the kitchen, where they get high and talk and bullshit and laugh and joke and get high and, you know, like. But this is amongst the family. Two sisters, two teenage brothers, two teenage sisters, two... My brothers were like maybe 3 or 4 years older than me, so they were like in their early teens.
You were the baby.
I was the baby. And they were smoking with my mother. Well, if they weren't smoking, they were like sitting in and catching the contact and enjoying it. You know, but I think they were smoking at that time. So it was my father, my mother, my two sisters, my two brothers, all in their teens or late teens. I came out of my room, my art studio, my back bedroom where I was drawing and listening to my Beatle records or whatever the fuck I was. I came out and said, I hate when you people smoke that shit. I didn't say shit, but I hate when you smoke that stuff. And I blew their high. Because they were all laughing and joking. And I come out, hey, yes, what's up? And I said, I hate when you smoke. And I was like, ugh.
You really killed you.
I blew their high. I buzzkill. Buzzkill. And they said, oh, why? Yes, why? Come, why you say that? I said, I don't know. I couldn't articulate, but I was 13. I was like, I was very outspoken at 13 because my mother worshipped the ground I walked on. And she thought I was like going to be the next president, for God's sake. You know, Barack Obama beat me to it. But she really had a lot of high hopes for me because I was a very bright kid. And so she, when I came out and had something to say, it was like, shh, you know, let's hear what he has to say. And then when I came out and say that, I was like, oh, wow, you know. And then, so she said, so why? Tell us this. Tell us why you don't like it. And I was like, it makes you, I don't know, you seem different. I don't know. My other parents aren't like this. I don't know. I just don't like it. I don't like it. And then my father said, well, I don't like being dictated to by a 13-year-old. And I was like, ooh. And that was such a put-down. And the way he said it, too, probably high, and pissed that I blew his joy, blew his killjoy. And the way, the feeling was just like, oh, wow. You know, that's hatred almost. That's hatred almost, Dad. Yeah.
Did you say that to him?
No, but I that's what it felt like. And so that shut me up immediately. And then he tried to ameliorate the situation by saying, you know, it's, our people have been smoking marijuana for years, for centuries. The American Indians smoked it. It goes back hundreds of years to the slave trade. And he gave a great history lesson, which was on point. He knew what he was talking about. But I still felt like, wow. So I should say, so what? Give me the needle then. Come on. You know, I mean, let's all be pot smokers. Let's all be drug heads. Let's all be drug addicts. I didn't say that, but my feeling was like, wow. He's justifying his habit. And I know it's wrong. I know it's wrong, and he's justifying it. And I was a lawyer in my youth. I was like very principled. And after that, I just shut up and just focused on surviving. I went back into my room. They continued laughing and joking and smoking, and I just said, I gotta survive this. That's where I'm living. Yeah. I never thought to myself, I gotta get out, because I wasn't prepared, I was ill prepared to fend for myself.
You were 13.
Yeah, but I did kind of think to myself, okay, just survive it. Survive it.
And so for all this time, from 13 to 22?
To 22, my father passed away. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. I drank maybe one. We all teenagers drink, let's just say that. Some get the buzz, catch the bug, and become alcoholics or frequent drinkers. I drank, got sick, drank again a couple of months or years after that, got sick again, or just drank to excess and realized, this ain't for me.
You were an artist.
Not my thing, yeah. So, there's old Jackson Pollock was an artist too, but he was also a raging alcoholic. But I just realized, and also my grandfather was an alcoholic. And so I got an early taste of what I didn't want in life by watching my grandfather and his drinking buddies. You know, that's a whole other story.
Did he live with you? Your
grandfather? Yeah, he lived with us upstairs in the upstairs bedroom. But, yeah, so I went to 22 when my father passed away, and I started smoking. And I had my first joint. It just blew my mind.
Do you remember what that was like?
Yeah. I was amongst friends with my brother and a family friend. I just started laughing, and it made me feel good. It made me feel good to laugh. I think I was a sullen kid after a while, like in my teenage years. I was just sullen and intense. And I started laughing. It felt good. Just release, you know, let it go. And then I looked over and saw my brother and my family and friend kind of watching me in their high. They were cool in their high because they were all pros by now. They were watching me. Issa's getting loose. He's getting loose. And they like seeing me get loose because I was always so principled and do-gooder, you know. So they were like, they're having a good time. Their high was watching me get high. I was their entertainment. You know? And I noticed that and felt that and felt uncomfortable, but I couldn't help it because I was high. It was my first high, and I was like, I felt like Jerry Lewis, you know. Madam, lady! You know, and I was just like I was all like crazy. And
what did you think of that?
I couldn't stop it. I couldn't help myself. You're free. There's a freedom to it. The key is not to get chained by the freedom, chained to the freedom. That's the key. I'm not, you know, the euphoria of marijuana is pretty persuasive. And that's why I have to be always mindful and always do maintenance on myself to make sure I don't ever forget that I can't smoke that shit. Because the euphoria still lives within me in the back of my head. Like, wow, yeah, you know. I'm satisfied and totally pleased with my life right now to the point where I don't need to drink, I don't need to smoke. But there is always in the back of my head that little guy who needs to laugh uncontrollably and not give a shit about HRA or not having any money or anything. And just like let go and release for an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours. And he's always back there, almost talking to me. Now he doesn't talk to me, but now that we're talking about this, he is talking to me. He's saying, "Yeah, you remember, don't you? You remember? I'm still there. If you want it, I'm not gonna twist your arm. I'm not gonna twist your arm, but yeah, I'm still there." And it's interesting and scary, but if you can control it, like I feel I can control it and have been controlling for almost 20 years, coming this next Labor Day in 2012, it'll be 20 years. If you can control it or at least keep it at bay, then you can have these conversations with yourself. See, I know you're in there, motherfucker. Yeah, don't call me motherfucker. We're friends. I ain't no friend of mine. You know what you did. You were there, too. It wasn't just me. You know, you just have this conversation with yourself. Don't forget, you're talking to yourself now. Oh, don't play those games. What games? You know, and just, yeah, this conversation with yourself. But, you know, he's still there. He's still there. That 22-year-old kid, his first get high. Yeah. It's persuasive. And that's what alcoholics deal with. They're trying to chase that first high. That's what crackheads. That's what heroin addicts. They all chase that first get high. They always want to feel that again because it is something you'll never forget. It is something you'll never forget. You know, when something else enters your mind and takes you someplace else that you never imagined. And it's similar with sex. Having your first sexual experience take you someplace else that you never imagined. And some men and women continually, even after they're married or while they're married, still search for partners to get that to get that feeling again. That wow, remember when? Oh, now I got this old lady or this guy. And, I mean, yeah, I love her, and there's love there, but oh boy, and you know, and you just I suffer from that too. So I've got. You know, the pot smoker and the sex addict in there, too. You know, it's like I'm walking down the street. Spring is coming. Spring is coming. And I know in the summertime when the bare legs and the sandals come out with the pedicures and the low-slung blouses, he's going to start talking to me. You see that?
I've been with you.
Man, you are.
We have a song about
he's
that.
He's spoken through me.
He's spoken. On the corner. He's spoken the yellow
to
dress.
Him. You've actually spoken to him. You know, I took a back seat, and he sat up front. He's like, yeah.
He drove us.
He drove us. I drove. Yeah. So he's very prominent. I'm trying to keep him in the back seat with the pot smoker too, and maybe even put them out of the car. If we can't put them out of the car, put them in the trunk.
Well, you know what James said when I asked him about. He said, "I'm." He went. He was having a negotiation with his inner child, and about something. His inner child wanted something. And I said, "Well, what if he doesn't agree with you or doesn't go along with you?" He said, "No, I'll send him back to the orphanage." His inner child. I said, "Well, brilliant." Yeah. But the dynamic thing here is. Let's just jump a little bit, because we're talking about marijuana. Part of your issues were heightened by...
Sure.
And you can actually trace it
mm-hmm.
to the first time you smoked,
mm-hmm.
as we just talked about. But, so now you're in a mental hospital.
What is the relationship to pot and drugs to people in the mental hospital?
The patients?
Yeah.
They love it. They can't stop smoking it. They want every chance they get. They can't wait to get out. Not to taste freedom, but to taste the reefer on their lips. And to taste feel in their lungs. They can't wait. And that's what a lot of them do. That's what a lot of them do. They can't wait to get out and get
even
high.
Even though...
So they don't make the connection. I didn't make the connection. I'm celebrating my 20th year free of marijuana. But that means that I've been in the system for 22 years. So the incident happened 22 years ago. And there was a latent period where I was in jail and I couldn't get it. And I mean, I come to Creedmoor, what do? I start smoking marijuana. So even after what happened, and knowing that it made me crazy and helped me and made me take my mother's life, when put in my face, I was like, you know, and I smoked again. So there's a lot of, and that's a major issue. Denial and lack of insight and just being addicted and having no hope and just saying, what the fuck? Let me smoke again. It feels good. It feels good.
My ex-wife was smoking for a while. We never smoked when we were together. And then she winds up with this guy who's smoking dope. And I said to her, what's it like for you? He said, well, you know, it makes you think that everything's okay when it's not.
Mm, mm-hmm. That's right.
And I thought, that stuck with me mm-hmm. 30 years.
It's only for 2 hours. Yeah. Those 2 hours.
You don't have to deal with anything. Everything's
right.
Okay.
That's right.
And that's pretty addicting when you think about
sure.
it.
Sure. People live their lives like that.
Well, what I'm trying to understand into is part of this psychophobia is also the effects of marijuana, both positive and negative, that we had talked about. What is the ratio of people who get unstable and wind up hospitalized, would you say?
I don't know. I'm sure there. You can talk to somebody else who has the numbers on that. But I just know a lot of people have gotten sick who smoke marijuana. And I'm sure there's a link. I spoke to a lot of guys who understand the link. Or have even said in conversation, yeah, I started smoking, then I got sick. But they'll still want to smoke. Even though they understand that there's a link. But they're still trapped up in that non-reality and wanting to escape to that non-reality.
But when I'm trying, would you say there's 5%? How many
I can't give you the numbers on, but I mean... I'd say 90 to 95 to maybe even 98% of people in Creedmoor have smoked marijuana. And of that 98% who have smoked marijuana, smoke marijuana, 85 to 90% of them, I think there's a causal connection. But that's just me.
That's your observation of spending 20 years as an investigative reporter.
I could be wrong. That could be skewing high. But,
I mean, you were there.
Certainly on the wards I was on. The Mike Awards, Mentally Ill Chemical Abusers Awards, the CAMI Awards, the Chemically Addicted Mentally Ill, all those wards, those guys were crack casualties, a lot of them. And you could tell them. Because that was a cocaine high. That was like the crack
kind. How do you tell the difference?
Well, marijuana is more of a downer. Cocaine is more of an upper. So when you smoke crack, to get more of it, you get hyper. And it's like, okay, where do I get more crack? Where's the crack? Where's the crack? Where's the crack? Where's the crack? Marijuana, you have a desperation to get more marijuana, but you've been narcotized. It's like you want to get laid back. You're almost desperate to relax. You want to mellow out on pot. You don't get high and get manic. You get high and relax and chill. You know, and there are a lot of marijuana heads, a lot of pot heads,
and crack heads too.
Hey, when I first got there in the early 90s, this is after the 80s. And the 80s and the 90s was the crack epidemic. So a lot of people coming in. A lot of people. White Jewish lawyers who lost it all because they just started smoking crack.
Now, you never smoked crack?
No.
You never did anything else other than...
Other than marijuana.
Other than marijuana.
Yeah.
You didn't do LSD? You
never did. I was afraid of LSD. I was afraid of crack. But LSD is like, what? You know? And that, I went on, I've been on several LSD trips. They're called psychosis. You know, from what I understand, LSD mimics psychosis. And so I know what it's like to have been on LSD and not come down. You know, so I have no desire. I've never been a garbage head, like how James calls it, or whatever, or someone who devours whatever drug is available. I've never been one of those types. But I did smoke marijuana because it was a part of my culture, part of my household, and it was made available to me. I was vulnerable because my father passed, and I was just so grief-stricken and vulnerable, and I smoked it. And unfortunately, because of the vulnerability, and at that time in my life, it was just what I needed. It was just what I needed. But then, and I kept smoking.
But fast forward a little bit. Then you had a decompensation you talked to me about where you were in the laundry room, the captain of the laundry. Can you talk a little bit about that? What that was like?
Well,
brought that on?
Marijuana. That's one of the times when I smoked, when I got it on the ward. And I was in Building 40, and I got a hold of some marijuana. This was the last time I smoked. I got a hold of some marijuana, and I got sick. I started thinking that the building was a spaceship, and every night it would take off. I'd almost feel it. I'd hear it. You know, and yeah, it's okay, it's taking off. But of course, the windows are, there's a projection on the windows to make it look like it's daytime and that the leaves are flashing and the cars are driving by. And it's like, you know, Queens again. Meanwhile, you're orbiting Saturn for the sixth time, you know, going through the rings of Jupiter or whatever. And I was piloting the spaceship. The dryers and the, it ran on the power of the dryers and the washing machine. So
in the laundry room.
In the laundry room.
Where you were.
I was a captain and the engineer. I was everything.
And you were also responsible for the laundry.
I had to do the laundry too, which sucked.
Really?
What's the captain and the engineer doing the laundry for?
What kind of a world are you living in?
What is this? You know, who's in charge? I'm in charge. Oh! Yeah, so I had to do the laundry, and then they'd line up every morning. I'd put the clothes on them, and some would resist because they see the shit and piss stains, because I was pissing and shitting in the laundry, because I felt that that helped pilot the ship better, because it was like a celestial ship, you know, because it runs on not only, like, nuclear or whatever kind of power, but also on my piss and my shit and my spit and whatever else I'm putting in there. And it's coming out all foul and befouled and people resisting putting, what's this? And I say, put it on. And if they refuse to put it on, I say, okay, you're marked. You know, and I'd know that, okay, they're one of the demons. Remember him, Greenberg. Okay, he's one of the demons. Remember him. And it was just a whole process. It was a whole play. And it went on for days. Until I finally got so sick that I realized I was on a ship full of demons, that I had no crew. It made sense to me. Okay, I'm the pilot, I'm the engineer, I'm the laundry guy, I'm probably cooking the food, don't even know it. I'm the only safe guy here. And I'm on a ship full of zombies and creatures. I realized, wow, I gotta get off this ship. So I decided to make a flag. So I took one of the sheets, and it was the flag of the working man, where I'd work up a sweat, I'd piss on it, I'd shit on it, I'd prick my finger with some contraband and bleed on it, I'd spit on it, I'd jerk off and cum on it, then I'd work up a sweat, I'd roll the sweat in it, and then do a Rorschach painting of my body, a body painting of shit, and I start crying. I'm crying, blood, sweat, and tears on this sheet, and that's the flag. That's my flag. That's my help me flag. It's Issa. You know, the good people in the celestial, wherever they are, they'd recognize that as me. So I'd hang this, and I realized, you know, I had very precious little time left. because people were noticing more and more that I was doing a lot of this stuff undercover, but people were noticing more and more, okay, Issa's getting a little weird in real time, you know? And so I realized they're on to me. You know, they're going to rush me. They're going to rush me. So I after making this flag, I hung it out the window and was screaming, "Help! Help! It's me! SOS!" And they rush into the laundry room, and the nurse has got her needle, and they hold me down, and then they're mad because I'm all covered in shit and piss and God knows what, and I'm naked. And they're like, "Oh, fuck it! Oh!" You know? So they didn't want to do that. But they had to hold me down. And the nurse gives me the needle. And I realize, okay, in lethal injection. Lethal injection. But God bless, you know, whatever. And I just hoped that whatever the outcome. And then after I woke up a day or so later in a bed in the hallway on 1-to-1. And there was a Spaniard and a couple of white guys all playing cards. And in my mind, I thought it was Miró, Dalí, Van Gogh, and Picasso playing cards. And it looked like them a little bit. One guy had a reddish beard, Picasso, and Van Gogh. One guy was a little bit older and kind of had a weird look in his eye, Picasso, you know. One guy was Spanish, I figured Miró. Dalí, I guess not the mustache, but he's kind of slender, you know, kind of. And I was thinking, they're playing cards. I'm like, wow, am I in heaven? Am I in heaven? Is this what they do in heaven? Is play cards? You know, and I fell asleep and woke up again and realized, okay, wait a minute. Did it work? Am I still alive? What's going on? And I realized I'm in a full sheet.
Which means what?
It's not a straitjacket, it's a full sheet restraint.
What is that like?
It's like a big canvas sheet pulled over you and you can't move except your head is out. And I thought, oh God, you know, I'm captive. I'm still on the death ship. And the zombies are walking around, the monsters are walking around, but they've got Issa, Jesus, held captive. You know? I'm like, oh shit, how am I going to get out of this? And then they sent me to secure when I got my medication again, and I kind of came down off the pot and got back on the wheel. But that was the last time I smoked.
Which was when?
That was 1992, Labor Day of 1992.
And you only smoked once?
No, I smoked maybe two joints over the course of 2 or 3 days.
And this episode of the Captain of the Laundry Machine.
It's over like a weekend or a week and a half, half of a week. The weekend of Labor Day and into a couple of days into till that Wednesday or Thursday when it just like reached its head. And they said, we got to send this guy to secure.
Secure means?
A secure care unit, which is like, as opposed to a regular ward, a unit of 30 or 40 patients. Secure care unit has only like 10 to 15, 10 to 12. And it's an intensive ward where you have like a bunch of staff and they're all big, beefy, black or white guys who will beat you mercilessly if you act up while they medicate you and get you stabilized to send you back to your regular ward and get back on the road of getting out of the hospital. But those guys don't play. They get paid extra, not to beat you, but because it's a very dangerous job because people have gotten killed and to kill patients and staff. Patients have gotten killed while being restrained by staff and having their necks broken or whatever. And I've been told, and it's a very true story, staff, not often, but staff have been killed and secure or attacked or bitten from AIDS, infected, or just, it's insane. It's insane. It's insane. That is like, while Creedmoor and mental hospitals get a bad rap for being, oh, the snake bit, it's still the same. It's not the same. There are elements that are reminiscent of that, but it's still very normalized. And if you're on a ward, everyone's on medication, and even though there's still some people who are kind of off the chain, it's kind of normalized. You can kind of navigate your way. You never drop your guard completely, but once you get a feel for it, you recognize, okay, this is how it is. Okay, watch that one. He's a little weird, but otherwise, you know. But Insecure, you can't sleep on the ward. Because I didn't. Because you know when somebody's gonna take a chair to your head. And you'll hear a chair thrown across the room, and then see somebody's being wrestled down. And then you'll hear somebody else. And then if it's a male and female ward, so one guy was fucking women in the ass. While right in front, while no one's, because sometimes there are blind spots, not often. But any opportunity they can find to fuck or do or get crazy, they will. So there was one guy, Roger, who was fucking Tanya in the ass, and she was a lesbian, but she went, I don't know, but that was pretty wild, right in front of me. Like,
right in front of you,
because staff moved out. The staff was either setting up for lunch or. And they never leave the patients unattended, but for some reason, ever so once in a while, patients are left unattended for just a second. And just that second. Yeah. And just, you know.
And this was consensual sex, obviously.
Yeah. I never saw a rape, but it was consensual sex. She may have asked him, or he may have said, you want to fuck? Or maybe they had an agreement from before. You want to do it again? Okay.
And how long did it last?
Less than a minute. Maybe a minute. We're not left alone for very long, but in that time, they're fucking. And it's a snake pit. It's dangerous. It's dangerously sexual. It's constantly noisy.
Yeah, take us through that.
Because the TV's on, the radio's on. The TV and the radio.
At the same time.
At the same time. Which is very bad because overstimulation, but they haven't figured that out yet. You know, because somebody wants to listen to the radio and somebody wants to watch TV and the others want to watch TV, so okay, let's keep them quiet. You listen to the radio, you listen to watch TV, and they just sit there and play cards while we all go insane. And someone's talking to himself over here, someone's laughing over there. An argument breaks out over there. Someone, it's just, and it's only like maybe 10 or 12 patients, but they're all like the most intensely unwell patients at the time. It always changes. There may be one or two people who were there for years because they're just like so completely insane. That, but not in a way where they have to get sent to Mid-Hudson or more dangerous facility, more secure facility. But there were like some perennials who were there for who just stayed there.
You mentioned the word chemical straitjacket.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember the times when there were physical straitjackets.
Yeah, I was in them. I was in a full sheet. The full sheet is worse. At least with a straitjacket, you can cradle yourself, comfort yourself. In a full sheet, you're just laid out on a bed, and there's a canvas sheet over you. And you can't move. You can move your head to the side. But that was terrible.
So tell me a little bit about the straitjacket's experience.
It's a straitjacket. They wrap you up. Takes a long time to wrap you up. Some people are quick at it, but not that quick. I mean, I can see why they outlawed it, only in that people getting hurt. Sometimes one woman kneeled on my head while the others were holding me down to get me in the straitjacket. And people can get hurt. I could have been, I don't know if I can say I could have been killed, but I was, while laying there, my face on the floor, on the linoleum, and a woman's knee on my head, I was, as sick as I was, I realized this could go south very quickly. Yeah, so let me just chill out. I always had the sense to realize, no matter how sick I was, that let's not get killed in here. Let's not get killed in here.
Yeah, that was not the thing to do. Did you come close to that?
No. I don't think so. People have. I've known people. I dedicate my ebook to the 5 or 7 patients who I knew who died before discharge, who died in the hospital, either getting accidental death or just heart attack. There was one guy, Julian, not our Julian, who I think he was killed by the staff.
Really?
Yeah. He was going on time. And he was insecure. And apparently he was always fighting, and always fighting the staff, and he was a big guy. Susan never met him. And she said he looks like a gladiator, so we'd call him, we had names for everybody. And he was the gladiator, because he was he had a very Roman face, you know, Roman nose, even though he was Hispanic, but he had that Aztec Roman thing going on, and he was broad and stiff back and just the best shape of his life. He was in his early 30s, and we got along very well, he and I. Because he couldn't speak very much English, but I was always nice to him, and I'd give him candies, I was good, I mean, that's a good way to, Deanna taught me that trick, too. You know, always feed the patients. Keep them occupied. Keep their hands and their mouth moving, and they won't lash out and punch you.
He learned that from being...
From
being punched.
Yeah, so I took that, I listened to that, I was like, okay, so I always had a lot of chocolates, you know, that I got from various people. So when he got, he realized, hey, wait a minute, this guy's got chocolate? So after a while, he became a bit of a nuisance. He'd knock on, Isa, please. And he couldn't speak English, so all he knew was Isa, please. Please, chocolate, please. Three words, Isa, please, chocolate. And he'd repeat that in various formations. Chocolate, Isa. Isa, please, please, Isa. Chocolate, Isa, please, Isa. Chocolate, Isa, please. Okay, yeah, I give him some chocolate and go away for another half hour or 2 hours. Because he was blowing up my spot. You know, because he'd come to my room where the room's supposed to be locked. I'm not supposed to be in there. And he's knocking on the door, opening the door from down the hall. Someone could look and see, what's Julian doing down in Issa's room? What's Issa doing unlocked? What's Issa doing in his room? And it becomes a whole big thing. It's like, oh, fuck, you know, because this guy wants chocolate. I got to sit in the day room now with the rest of these knuckleheads. So that was a bit of a problem. But we got on very well. But he ended up insecure, and he had a beautiful sister. Latina, like you don't know. And a very nice mother who loved him. And I'm sure her heart was so broken when she found out they died. She had two kids, her daughter and her son, and she always came to visit her son. And she brought her sister, her daughter, his sister sometimes, and she was kind of like some sisters will be in a situation like that, you know. They'll smile and maybe show a little bit of familial camaraderie or simpatico, but more often than not, it's like an inconvenience for them. It's, you know, and they give you shit. She gave him shit and would argue as some sisters or siblings would do when put in that situation. But he ended up insecure for one last time. And I was getting reports from people down there saying he's biting people. And they thought he had AIDS. And I think he may have had, even though he was in great condition, they say he may have been infected. But just the fact that he's biting people, even if he doesn't have AIDS, people automatically think he must have AIDS. Does he have AIDS? He's biting people. But he bit this one guy, and he wasn't having it. And took him into his room, and they got into a tussle. And the guy said, I heard this from the priest, who said it happens a lot more frequently than you realize. See, Creedmoor has a fund where they settle all the time. You never see it hit the papers. But there's accidental deaths, and there's even like not so accidental deaths all the time, and they settle all the time. Millions of dollars. Or whatever the family, whatever they think they can get the family for. And this was just another case of that. And he was dead. Killed or whatever, but it was questionable because he bit the guy, then the guy went away, bandaged his wound, and then came back into the room. And then said something like he just walking by and just peeked in and then saw something going on and he attacked him, so he had to subdue him, and then somehow his neck got broke or some shit like that. But, he got suffocated, he died, suffocation, heart attack. But, yeah. So.
Did you ever run into that yourself?
No. I was always, not only just didn't I run into it, but I was always very, very well protected by, the Creedmoor staff. Very well protected.
What's it sound like in there? I mean, what is
it? It's a cacophony. It's cacophonous all the time. There's always overstimulation. If you go into a day room or into one of the rooms that are open at some point and it's quiet, if just for a moment, you know it, you feel it, and you stay there. If you appreciate it at all, you stay there and go, until somebody else comes in. What's on TV? Turns on the TV. Or what's on the radio? And turns on the radio. Or wants to play ping pong. Or which, you know, or who wants to do God knows what else and blow your silence, blow your peace, you know. But there's always some kind of noise, some kind of sound.
Were you painting and drawing?
Yeah, I had a Walkman, and I'd bring my canvases out, and for a while I had an easel, and years ago, like, for a while, I was bringing out big canvases, and I realized this isn't going to work. I was creating a spectacle. I had oil paints on water crazy people. And while it was too much maintenance to wash the oil paints, wash your back, paint creatively with abandon, it was, yeah. So I didn't do very many large-scale paintings after like 1997 on the wards. But I did a lot of small ones on acrylic, which is a non-toxic paint, more or less. You know.
Now, I have one. I bought one of your paintings.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
What's the story with that one?
That was during my last decompensation, around the time of the Cosmic Knockout. When the Cosmic Knockout was written, it's written about that experience, my last decompensation in 1997, 98. And right around that time, I was doing some paintings. And I thought the devil was after me. And it was a painting of the devil. Coming out of the closet. Like that. Yeah, and that's just what he's doing. And his shroud, he wears a shroud, and his shroud is half open. You see his ribs. You know, but it's Satan. Hanging out in my closet. And I am afraid of the dark. I was realizing that just the other night. Maybe last night or some night, not too recently. Not too distant, not very recently. I'm afraid of the dark.
Still?
I'm afraid of the dark, yeah. My mind, there's something in my mind that is almost like not in control, or I'm not in control of, that when the lights go out, something will say, you know, a ghostly, horrific thought will pop into my mind just to scare me. Or just not to scare me, but just a ghost, or the dead, or and it's so I'll quickly jump into bed and get under my covers. Or sometimes, even when Susan doesn't like it, when she comes sleeps over, I crack the door open so I'll get some light from the outside hallway into the room. So I can at least see a shadow, as opposed to being totally enveloped in darkness and not know what the hell is in there waiting for me.
Dark, huh?
Yeah, afraid of the dark.
Even as a kid?
I don't know. But certainly after this experience, getting sick and losing my mind and being afraid of the creepy crawlies in the dark, it stayed with me. It's either something I took with me as a child, like I had as a child and forgot about or didn't really think that much of, but definitely something that really awakened when I got sick. In the comforts of my own room, too. Because it's me that I'm afraid of. It's my past. It's my mother. The dead body of my mother. It's dead ghosts. It's the devil. It's demons. It's yeah. No matter they haunt me no matter where I go in the dark. They're after me. It's not where I'm at. You know. It's not because I'm in a psych center where people have died, which has crossed my mind too. You know, people have died. Yeah, maybe the ghosts of the dead patients are lingering. You know, I'm telling myself a ghost story and my shivering under my covers. But it's just no. Satan wants me. And that's just not that I think this like in an active sense, but like if I let myself go there, which I don't, but if I were, it would, you know, and then I'll stop myself, oh, that's such bullshit. Why don't you stop with that? Why don't you stop that shit? Why don't you grow up? I even said that to myself a couple of times. Why don't you grow up? Afraid of dark. Grow up.
What the shit are you talking? Satan, demons, ghosts. You want to turn the light on? What do you want to do? But let's get some sleep.
You know, talk to yourself like that?
Yeah, I do. I talk to myself just like that.
Let's get some sleep. Yeah. Sometimes you need to do that to be the father to the child.
Sure. Time to go to bed. 4 o'clock.
Yeah, you went to bed at 4:30 in the morning. 4 o'clock.
What? Do you want to get up? Get up. Right. Go on the right. But sit or get off the pond. Don't lay here. You know. Close your eyes. Stop thinking. Relax. Turn the radio. Why? Are you listening to it? You just got to, like, tell yourself. And that's how I treat people sometimes. It's not too cool. But I sometimes... I don't treat people like that often. But I've been known to just kind of, like, get a little short with people. And just kind of say, hey, look, what are we doing? Yeah,
we've done that with me. Yeah, right. But that's okay. We know each other.
Yeah.
I mean, we know each other.
I'm very congenial with people. When I know people well enough, then I let that side of me come out, which is the side of just, like, take charge. Like, okay, don't waste my time. I won't waste your time. Let's do what we got to do, but let's do something. Let's not just sit here and jerk each other off, you know, by the campfire. Let's do what we got to do, or not do it, but let's do something. And so I've been known to slip into that mode occasionally, and it's helpful. It's useful for me when I motivate myself to do that, because it motivates me. It's like, okay, you're right. It's the voice of reason. It's my voice of reason.
You mentioned something the other day about your first painting.
Ed Sullivan. I don't know if that was my first painting. That's one of many that I did at 2 and 3 and 4 that my mother really liked and decided to frame and hang up in the house.
What's the content of it?
It's Ed Sullivan. It says The Ed Sullivan Show, or Ed Sullivan, in red lettering. He's wearing a green suit, but he's a hairy, green, like ape-like monster, and he's laughing. Yeah. Cause I was, maybe I think about this because I used to think when Ed Sullivan would laugh, it wasn't a very attractive looking laugh. He's an ugly man. He's an older man too. I mean, maybe in his youth he was attractive, but when I was watching him, he was an ugly old man. And whenever he would laugh, which wasn't very often because he was always like a sourpuss, it's like, well, that's a weird laugh. So I think that may have been the impetus for drawing.
You're good at ventriloquism or mimicking people. mimicking. Can you do an Ed Sullivan?
Right here on our show, we're gonna have Topo Gigio and Soupy Cheryl's coming up, and the great Gio Geller with his tape recorder taping me. Right after these messages from Downy Soap, take it away.
I don't know if that even sounds like.
No, it wasn't bad.
And there's like really big shoe. There's like the very there's very obvious cliched Sullivan, but I think you got to restrain him and come in, because he wasn't all just like red shoulder and the shoulders. I mean, that's like a caricature, but he was a little more to him than that, from what I remember.
Right, you were 3 or 4 then.
I lived for that show.
That's the first time you saw the Beatles?
Yeah, so they showed reruns of the Beatles. And I was like, yeah.
Okay, they came in 63.
They came in 64.
64,
right. Long before I was born, like a year before I was born. But he'd always talk about them. They whenever there was a new song that they'd come out with, they'd show a promotional film. They wouldn't play on the show live, but they'd show promotional films of the Beatles that they'd make. And instead of playing live at shows, they'd send promotional films to the show of the song, and you'd see them in a promotional film. That's how I got to see them. And many other acts that really impressed me. It's just musical variety, which is
What is it about your relationship to art and music, and the curse and the gift of mental illness?
That's a big question. The curse and gift of mental illness is like 10 minutes. My relationship to art and music is another 20 minutes. I can't answer all that. I'm getting hungry. Maybe we have to answer that for another time. My relationship to art and music is a part of my life. My mother was an artist and a writer, and she loved music. My dad was a musician and an artist and a writer. So it was a part of my upbringing. It was always there. And as a result, I'm an artist, a writer, and a musician. So it's just it's in my DNA. I don't know anything else. I can barely do math, but I can sure sing a show tune. But no, it's just a part of my DNA.
But when you got sick, what did it change?
I was glad I had it when I got sick, even though after a while I couldn't create. But the getting sick process, you do paintings, you do drawings, you sing, you do creative endeavors. And those are probably the greatest things you could ever do, and you can never touch them again while saying.
Yeah, talk to me about that. That fine line between euphoria and creativity and sanity and...
Well, it's just, I recognize that some of the paintings I did before it became mud. And before it became like disjointed songs and disjointed things that didn't make any sense. Before it reached that point, it's godlike almost. Because you are touching something else. You are in another realm. You are in another realm. The realm that all some of the great artists wish they could touch. And so in the realm that some other artists and creative people take drugs to try and touch. You know, performance enhancing. But, no, it's the best stuff I've ever done. Is when I've been on my way to illness. Like if this is total madness, I'm on my way. That's when it's just.
It's not when you get there. When you get there, you're too.
When I get there, it just doesn't work. But on the way, it's just knocking them out, and they're all brilliant. And none of them exist. There was some songs I did a whole album. I wrote a whole album. That's lost. I did on pizza napkins and greasy pizza napkins and toilet paper and I did on whatever I could. And I swear to you, it was the best stuff I ever did. I'll never touch it again.
Now, is this when would you describe that period as manic?
I was going insane. I don't put a diagnosis on it, but I was going insane. And the paintings I was doing, which none of them exist anymore because I'd ripped them up or overpaint, but there was a point where I'd look at it and go, yeah, that's it. And then the thing is, I didn't have anybody to give them to and say, take this paint. I keep them in the room so that by the time I'm going crazy...
Well, I had to buy one of your paintings so that you wouldn't give it away recently.
Well,
you remember?
I do. But bills do need to be paid.
But when you're on that way up to whatever, to get being insane where you're too...
Well, you can't work.
You can't work.
It doesn't make any sense. It's not cohesive. It's not coherent. It's not.
But you're. What's that? What's going on there?
It's just. You're just alive. You're who you really are. Before you go totally insane and you become. And then you're really who you are. You're in a really scary place. You know? But that period. When you get past that period where you're totally insane, that is who you really are. That's probably who you. We are in a very primitive sense. But that period leading up to it is who you are in all your majesty.
In your what?
In all your majesty.
In all your majesty.
Yeah. If you can say that. You can kind of get what I'm trying to say.
No,
In all your brilliance. That's when you're just... You know, it would take a couple of weeks or so. And you're working out. And before you know it, you're a machine. I mean, you look the best you've ever looked. You're not eating shit anymore. You're drinking more water. You're eating, but you're eating the right things because you're paranoid and think they're trying to poison you. So you eat what's safe, but you also eat what's healthy. So within a couple of days or a week, you're like, you're looking great. You're feeling great. You're shitting regularly. You're not on any medication because you're decompensating. So you're not constipated anymore. you're at your very best, and you're creatively alive. I wrote a whole album, and the songs are pouring out of me, and they're good, and they're just like so perfect. And the paintings you're doing are just like just transcendent. And you're in the zone. You're in the zone.
But you can't stay there.
You can't.
Why?
Because you're going crazy. You don't have a lot of the insecurities and a lot of things that hold you back in your sanity. Because when you're sane, you have insecurities, you have second thoughts, self-doubt, you second guess yourself.
Your reality. And
you may be good because you have talent. If you have any talent, you'll still be good. If you have any talent at all, you know, there'll be some worth to it in a very
safe
and conservative way. I mean, maybe even a little more than that. You may kind of like really like push the envelope, but you burn the envelope and piss on it when you go crazy, before you go totally crazy. The envelope doesn't exist. And you're just, everything is just up for grabs. You draw from things that you wouldn't even imagine. You start playing jazz. And I don't know how to play jazz, but you're playing jazz. It's your own kind of jazz. And it's almost like something that you're inventing. Because you can't play jazz, but it's kind of like jazz, but something else, and there's other things thrown in there, and it's like, wow, this is interesting. I like this. And it's just crazy. It's crazy. Because there are no boundaries. There are no borders. And it's hard to maintain that. It's hard for me to maintain that. I don't ever want to... If I could live in that, it'd be beautiful. But I need somebody to catch me every once in a while. And there's no way of sustaining that. There's no way of sustaining that. Because it's always ramping up to something worse. And inevitably you're going to have to be put on something that will take you back. There you go again. And you take it back. Yeah. And before you know it, you're living like some kind of jack-in-the-box. You know? And it's just... it's no way to live.
Do you find yourself almost like a spirit without a body?
I don't know. I feel lighter. I feel lighter. I feel lighter. Yeah, I feel lighter. Because there's more spring in your step. You know? So you just feel more alive. You feel one with the world. You feel almost like flying, but you can't.
But you can't.
Well, you can't physically fly, but you feel like flying. You feel like at any moment, I'm going to take off. But you can't. But it's okay, because you can create something. For me, that's how I treat it. Now, other people who don't do creative stuff, heaven only knows what they do when they're in that state. But for me, I'll never forget those states. I think David feels the same way. You'll never forget him, because it's when you really were walking hand in hand with God.
And the meds.
What about the meds?
The chemical straitjacket.
Yeah.
When you finally you had to get a shot.
Mm-hmm.
How did that what happened there?
I got went crazy, and they had enough of it. Of me, this was like probably my second or third decompensation on the oral meds. And I said, this is ridiculous. We can't trust this guy on this. And so we want him on an injectable. And they came to me and said, we'd like you on an injectable, and here's why. You're on an oral med, and you always come off it, and you always decompensate, and you put us through trouble, you put yourself through trouble, you're not doing us doing any good, not doing yourself any good, do you realize that? Okay, you don't realize that, all right. Well, anyway, we want you on injectable medication, everything's going to be resting for you, okay? Would you like to agree to that? No, I don't. Oh, well, you know what we can do? We can take you to court and force it on you, you know, if you lose your case. And then we can, I'm just going to let you know, we can physically hold you down and give you a shot every month, or as needed. Would you like that? No. Oh, well, you know, it's on you then. And then they give you a little time to deliberate and think about it. And they come up to you again. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to take the injectable medication. Here's our reasons. Do you want to go to court? Oh, you want to go to court? Okay. And then it's okay. They say, all right. No further discussion. See you in court.
And
they do give you a chance to change it. They gave me like a month or two. Gave me a long time. And I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And of course, I couldn't make a rational decision. And of course, I'm thinking, and the needle is getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I'm getting sicker. And when I'm thinking about it, you know? So. But I'm glad it happened.
So walk me through that, because I know the story a little bit, but I think this is an interesting point in terms of. So you went to court.
Went to court. I actually was adjourned several times.
And why did you not want to get shot?
Because I had the stigma and the fear. And at first, I had no lack of insight, and I was crazy. I had lack of insight. And I was in denial, and also. I believe the stigma of getting a shot, isn't that what crazy people get? Come on! And meanwhile, I'm crazy. I'm smearing shit all over the place. You know, as I'm smearing shit on the walls, I'm not going to get a shot. Get out of here. You know, meanwhile, you're peeing down the hallway. You're smearing shit on the phone so nobody else will use it. Then you use it and buy the steak out. Well, that's mine, okay.
You ever run into somebody else's shit?
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't the only one.
That was very popular.
Oh, yeah, shit is a big popular.
That was very popular. And then smearing it on the phone. I got, once that happened to me, I was like, oh, man. And the unit chief was right next to me. Somebody smeared shit on the phone. We'll clean it up. And I guess that is the natural, you know, it's. That is what you do. You know, if you got it, but it was like, wow, I got done. Okay, that's like getting a hot foot or getting, you know, that's like, my turn. Thank you. Thanks, Frank. Love you.
But you knew the guy.
Because he's sitting naked in the day room.
Oh,
shit. He'd get naked and he had a thing about disrobing. He'd just take his clothes off and sit naked in the day room. Composed.
I'm composed.
Like this.
He was an artist. Like a gentleman.
Like a gentleman. With his legs crossed. Sitting naked in the day room. And he'd walk up and down the hall. One time he put in the phone and put it back in the
And you picked it up.
And I picked it up. I was the one. I'll never forget that. Yeah, there is no more disgusting. There's no more disgusting thing.
Well, you had a guy who... took up the phone a good part of the time.
Yeah, Pablo. I don't get into Pablo. Pablo was a whole other discussion. Pablo was a book.
He was a book.
Pablo was a
book.
But shit
is a big thing with
shit is a big thing. It's the ultimate rebellion. Because that's the one thing. And I mean, as I'm expressing it now, I'm smelling somebody else's shit. Is like, oh, my God, why? And that's the ultimate rebellion. And I'm guilty as charged. I did the same. I did it too. I was writing star and crescents, my name in Arabic on the walls. That's the only thing I know in Arabic. Star and the crescent.
Your father converted from.
No, he converted to Islam. Yeah.
But he wasn't born.
No, he wasn't born. He was born.
That's how, and the name Isa, it means
it's
what?
Jesus. Mm-hmm.
Did you have that?
Of course. That's the crux of my whole illness. Just waking up one morning and realizing I'm Jesus.
How old were you then?
24.
You woke up in the mental hospital then?
No, it was before my mother's death.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I got a flood of voices and images. It was like a jigsaw puzzle, It's like a video jigsaw puzzle, if you can imagine that. Overlays of images, kind of like, you know, and I had to decipher them. And a flood of voices and sayings and phrases. And in the end, the puzzle was put together after hours, and I said, "Oh, Jesus, wow, okay."
What was that like?
It's horrifying, because I realized that it's bad enough. It's not bad enough you're Jesus. It's pretty cool that you're Jesus, but it's bad when Satan's trying to kill you.
Oh, that could be problematic.
Yeah, and he's got all his minions. The world is a major overthrow of evil going on. A whole major plot. It's got your mother downstairs, and it's like, oh, wait a second. Where's the glory? Wait a minute.
I need that for this job.
Terrible. It was the second coming. It was Revelation. I was Jesus in Revelation. But I had to kick ass. And have people try and kick my ass. And I wasn't prepared for it. I had to learn on while doing it. I had to learn on the job. And it's like, oh, come on. Where's God? Where's God? Help me out.
I'm only Jesus. Where's God?
Thank God is nowhere to be found. God died. He was my father. Oh, you had a chance to talk to him. Oh, of course, I know. But I didn't know I was Jesus back then. Crazy, crazy. It's scary. It's horrifying. It's horrifying.
How long did that last?
From finding out until my mother's death, about 2 days.
Oh, really?
In fact, I got one of the messages I got was, we'll be dead in 2 days.
Really?
That was one of the messages I got. Yeah, there's like a flood of voices, we'll be dead in 2 days.
But you don't normally have visions and voices.
No, I don't. That was the first and probably the last time. I have a lot of delusions when I'm sick. But that one time, the day before my mother's death, was the first and only time I had auditory and visual hallucinations.
Well, and you were smoking? How much pot were you smoking?
The same as I always was. I think it just built.
And you built up the resistance.
It just,
or the lack of resistance.
It just blew. It was building and building, and I was going crazy for 8 or 9 months before then, and then it just.
You said you went to one of your family members.
My sister in California, yeah, and who's a nurse. I quit my job in New York, and I went out to her in Oakland, California. Beautiful. Took me a ride on. And as we were riding up to Oakland Hills, she says, "Break out that reefer." I was like, I don't know. I think I'm smoking too much. Yeah, you're smoking too much. Break out that reefer. I'm smoking. Break out the reefer. Okay. I break out the reefer. I'm rolling. Roll that fast. Okay. I'm rolling. Now, what's he talking? What are you talking about? You smoking? Nah. I'm feeling sick. I'm having strange thoughts. I'm feeling like, I think I'm losing. You're losing your mind. You know, I got 3 kids and no man. I should be the one seeing the psychiatrist. You know, smoke more. Smoke some more. Light that up. What, you want to be in a mental hospital with people prying into your business? Strangers prying into your business, surrounded by crazy people doped up on medication? Is that what you want? I was made to feel like an idiot. I was made to feel like a child. So I realized she couldn't help me.
But you asked her to help you.
I said, I think I need some help. I think I need to see a doctor. I didn't know how to sign myself in. I didn't know the process that I could just walk into a hospital. I know what the hospitals were, first of all, let alone how to walk in and sign yourself in. I didn't know anything about that.
And what would you have said if you would have signed yourself in?
I don't know. I would have said what I told her. I went to her, as I did to my mother a couple months later, and said, I think I'm going crazy. I feel strange. I'm having strange thoughts. I think I'm going crazy. You know when you're going crazy. I say it in the book. You know when you're going crazy. You can question your sanity. And you know when you're going over the line. You know it. You know. If you've lived long enough in insanity,
in
a state of sanity, you know when you've crossed the line. And I knew it. I knew I was just going deeper and deeper and deeper into it.
And nobody to talk to.
Nobody to talk, except her, my mother.
And what did your mother say?
She rubbed healing oil on. She said, oh no, don't tell me it's mental.
Did you have mental illness in your family before?
No. Not as far as I know. Well, maybe they knew something and I didn't. I, as far as I know.
But how would you know it's not, you know?
In the black community, it's a secret. It's a deep, dark secret, you know?
Yeah, so what is it about the secret?
It's like the Asian community. They don't accept it. You're not supposed to see a psychiatrist, be on medication. They'd rather keep you in a back room somewhere where you smoke and they feed you meals under a door before they send you to a psychiatrist or a mental hospital. It's just not done. It's a blight on them. You know? It's a blight on the Asian community. I think it's different for the Asian. I think Asian community and some other communities have a different way of looking at it. Maybe they look at it as a shame. But in the African-American community, there is the shame involved. But more so, it's because the history of misdiagnosis and mistreatment by mental health, by health professionals. So that has developed into don't trust the doctors, especially the white doctors. And there are no black psychiatrists that I've seen, as they'd say. So you're going to be dealing with white doctors who are going to probably want to lock you up for the rest of your life because you're black. Because that was happening, especially in the 60s, with the whole protest psychosis thing. You know, where if you speak up a little too loudly against a white man, they think you're paranoid schizophrenic and put you on Haldol and lock you up. So, it's understandable, but so not that I understood any of that. I understand it. No, I understand, but I can understand why people in my community were like, you're not crazy.
You can't be crazy.
You're not crazy. Get your shit. My sister said that. Get your shit together, man. Get your shit together. As if to say, you're black in America. Fight it. Keep it together. But get your shit together.
Where it's interesting, in Africa, the communities in the villages, they would come together. And I know an example of this where they would, in Namibia, where they would, somebody was having a mental issues, the whole community would come together and dance with them for days. Until they realize they would dance this out of them.
Mm.
But they would also realize that they were in a family, that they weren't alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the issue of mental illness is isolationism.
Yeah. You isolate yourself and then you're isolated from society. Yeah, I know.
And that's part of the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also self... you once said to me, the definition of insanity.
Its roots are in sane, which is sanitation, it's cleanliness. And insanity is like unsanity, unsane, unclean. And a lot of mentally ill people in the back when they were doing the root words were filthy, unclean. And we thought then there was like a root, healthy body, healthy mind. And various other sayings like that. So they were thought that because of their physical hygiene, that somehow it affected their mental hygiene.
But and yet we know people who have who are odoriferous.
Oh yeah.
So that sanity may apply to some people.
Hmm.
But. And one last thought, because I can, is talk to me a little bit. You wrote in the cover of your book about sanity is too insane and insanity is the refuge from sanity.
Sanity is too insane. Well, there's a tremendous lack of responsibility when you're crazy. You can get away with almost anything. A lot of people feel that way when you take the insanity plea after committing a crime, that you're getting away with it. And there are a lot of people who feel that, oh, he's using that as an excuse that he's crazy if he acts a certain way. And perhaps there are people who... I always hear that more so from the outsider or the spectator, and never... ever have I heard that from the actual sufferer. So that could be just a misconception that insanity is the refuge, or insanity is the
Well, let's take it from a different tack. You see people talking to themselves on the street, people going over exaggerated actions. It was told to me by somebody that maybe what the people are doing is trying to rebalance, take back the balance that they've lost by being out of control, and they're trying to control something, and they're trying to get it out of their mind, so they're laughing, they're talking to themselves, they're trying to, even though they're exaggerated to the outside world, but what's going on in their minds is even worse.
That seems like an over-intellectualization of somebody who's got something on his mind that makes him laugh. And his borders are down, his boundaries are down, and he laughs a real maniacal, but not in a bad way, but just like a real unbridled laugh, you know.
Well, you used to do that.
I think I told you. Yeah, I had a maniacal laugh, and it was just like it was just.
What do you mean a maniacal?
It was high, and really just a laugh of a maniac, laugh of a maniac. When I'm not medicated, everything's funny. I amuse myself, and I laugh. So you don't want to over intellectualize, even intellectualize in the slightest way. Things that people who are diagnosed, even undiagnosed, but show signs of mental illness. As what their thinking processes are, what, you know.
Well, what I was thinking about is sometimes those what seems to be to aberrations to other people are maybe compensations, even from something that may be even worse going on inside. Well, I'm trying to understand the.
There's some things you just can't understand, you know. This is why it's not an exact science to this day, and it's still. Playing with it,
but it's part of the stigma. You see people on the street,
right? But something just can't. Don't try to understand what's going on in their head. Just know that they're in a state of whatever state they're in. Don't try to understand. That's like trying to read somebody's mind. And as far as I know, and I certainly hope we can't read anybody's minds yet. Although I had issues with that.
Tell me about it.
No, I can't go into that. But we'll never be able to read in each other's minds. So, you know, you just don't... That's like chasing your tail, you know. So don't worry about what somebody's thinking or the rationalization or trying to understand. Just know that they're in a state of whatever state they're in. And if you see them on the street, you know...
What should you do?
What should you do? That's a good question.
What do you do?
I just walk by them a lot. I look at them. See myself in them sometimes. If they're angry, I'll think back when I was angry. If they're laughing. Laughter's contagious anyway, so I kind of laugh with them. And smile to myself, and sometimes that would come across on my face. They're having a good time. Something's funny. You find something funny. Yeah. The singing themselves, that's perfectly okay, because I think there should be more singing in the world. But I see a lot of myself and people on the street who are going through whatever they're going through. I just hope it's not so traumatic. I just hope that if it does get to a point where they're being tormented by themselves or things within themselves that take on the appearance or to them as exterior things when really they're all interior, then I hope they can seek help or find peace somehow.
And just to tie up this segment of our conversation, psychophobia. What do you think about when you think of that?
I think of my family, who are a case study in psychophobia. They've abandoned me. One or two of them, try to understand. My middle brother, who I was very close to, more so than my older brother, he came to visit me once when I first got arrested and I was in Kings County Hospital. And he came and asked questions and tried to understand. And my older sister, who I was also very, very close to, who I love dearly, who influenced a lot of my interest in sci-fi and horror and fantasy, we kind of connected for a significant period of time, maybe a year or two. And then drifted apart because her husband at the time realized that there was money to be had and that he was either going to try and coerce me into giving whatever money that he thought I was going to get to him or my sister, which meant him, or he was going to try and screw me out of it. And when he realized he couldn't do either, he just got nasty and ugly. And I realized that, and then it became impossible to get to her without him, because he wasn't working, so whenever I'd call home, he'd pick up the phone, and I couldn't get to her, and I'd have long conversations, and then I'd have eventually long arguments with him, as he'd insult me, and I'd take the insults in the hope that eventually he'd get tired of insulting me and put her on the phone. Eventually, it was just like nothing but insult sessions. I realized, wow, this is not good for me, so I stopped calling home. But they have psychophobia. One or two of them tried to understand. But by and large, they just see this terrible thing that happened. And they've been told, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, how it happened or why it happened, supposedly. And I guess they don't buy it. And don't want to know. Don't want to know. So,
what would you say to them and to other people who have psychophobia?
It's not what you think. Find out. Don't be ignorant. Find out. It's not what you think. Whatever you think, it's not what you think. Until you know exactly what someone's going through, until you talk with somebody who's experienced whatever it is that you're afraid of about regarding your psychophobia or how it manifests itself. Until you've spoken with someone and really had a firm, clear, concrete understanding of what that experience is, don't assume you know. And certainly don't stigmatize and don't, cast people out or discriminate as a result of your ignorance or what you think. I call it the ignorance, but what they think they know or assume or whatever. Because it could happen to you.
It happened to you.
It happened to me. It could happen to you. And then what are you going to do?
And if it's happening to you, what?
Seek help. Seek help. Seek help.
And what about if you smoke?
And if you feel like you've been failed by the system, still seek help. Still seek help. It's out there. And it's not the best system in the world, God knows. There are a lot of butcher shops operating as hospitals. And there are a lot of charlatans and quacks operating as doctors. But there are also a lot of good people who want to help and can help. So seek help.
What about those people who are feeling unstable because of marijuana?
Stop smoking. If you ever notice that you're feeling unstable, stop smoking if you can. Or you'll end up in a basket case. Or you end up in an asshole. Nothing else. No one wants to be an asshole. No one even less wants to be a basket case. But I think it's even worse to be an asshole. You know? There's no medication for that.
No medication for being an asshole. No. Not yet.
They're working on it, I'm sure.
They're working. Okay. One last thing. I'm going to put this on hold. So maybe you have a song in there that you'd like to end this section with.
Am I in tune? This song, 1997. Right before I started to really slip and go insane, it was a balm to myself.
A balm.
A balm to myself.
B-A-L-M.
Yes. So I've written a lot of songs to myself. Memo to myself. And this is one of them. It's probably one of my favorites. I don't know why, but I like it.
Did you ever wonder if you were trapped in a concrete jungle without a map? Waiting for your chance, you can escape to the nearest faraway place. It may seem like something that's hard to do, run away to heaven, just me and you. Were you free to do so, you'd love the taste of the nearest faraway place. We'll go, they'll go, others will stay behind. They've lost their minds, but we're just getting started. There will be no broken-hearted people walking around with their heads undone, bringing tears and frowns home to everyone. There will be no shame and no disgrace in the nearest faraway place.
Right after that, I took my Hell doll. Starving ever since.
We'll go, they'll go, others will stay behind. They've lost their minds, but we're just getting started. There will be no broken-hearted people walking around with their heads undone, bring tears and frowns home to everyone. There will be no shame and no disgrace in the nearest far away.
So, how do you feel?
Hungry.
Good, let's go get something to eat.
Alright, good. Yeah, we may even use some of that.
No, I think we'll use most of it, actually. You know why I think we'll use most of it?
Why is that?
Because it flowed.
Yeah, it did.
And I think it was real. And it showed the part that I think we wanted to show, which was that the insights into that your experience that we're coming to this psychophobia from a real place, not just an intellectual research thing. But I would like to do it more with some musical interludes as well.
I was thinking there are parts that I did want to start playing.
Yeah, I wanted you to do that, but I didn't want to say anything.
I know, yeah. Because I probably would have felt pressured.
Right. That's right. I'm always careful of that.
Well, also, I don't know. Sometimes I feel it. Sometimes there are times I want to do something in my hands, and then other times I realize, I don't know.
Maybe we'll record some more. Do some other interviews. But,
yeah. No, but I think there were... I think there were great, insightful, energetic moments.
Yeah. Well, it's a wild story.
Yeah, it is a... I mean, but the real story is the humanity in it.
And in the end, what we said in this segment about, what do we tell people? Get help.
Yeah.
Go somewhere. Try and help yourself. And even if it's a butcher shop, go find someplace else.
Yeah. Keep trying. Keep trying, because it's out there. I've been helped.
Yeah, no.
Susan doesn't feel the same way, although at the same time, she had to really look for it, but she's now found a guy who saved her life.
Right.
So the system, in terms of Creedmoor and the various other hospitals, millions of 40 other hospitalizations she's had, weren't helping her. But she did keep searching, and it was out there for her.
So, well, the interesting thing with Susan, who I hope that we'll talk to with this, is that she needed to come to terms and to help, want to help.
That's true. I feel that way. I can never say that. I don't think you should say it either. But she'd have a hard time admitting. Maybe not. She wouldn't have a hard time admitting it. Maybe not. But
I think
there was a long time where she just wanted. She was angry and she was hurt and she was traumatized
and she was abandoned.
And the last thing, and she was abandoned and neglected and abused. I mean, so it's easy to see why the last thing she wanted to do was then have somebody tell her, you know, you could try a little bit harder. You know, you could really look for. That's the last thing she wanted to hear. You know, I found myself doing that when I was calling it like I saw it, and sometimes that wasn't the best tact.
But it was on her own that she came up with the idea. I want to pay for a psychiatrist or a therapist. That, I think, was the real brilliant move that she took. So should we go get some of these?
Yeah, we should think about
what time is it
organizing now? Our time.